From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. A state legislative commission recently jumped into the debate over paying college athletes. You'll learn why one former state Supreme Court justice is turning to the North Carolina Constitution to address the topic. Social media is having a major negative impact on political discourse. That's the assessment from Jonah Goldberg. Hear what he had to say during a recent visit to Chapel Hill. North Carolina's latest teacher turnover report offers some good news. We'll get an expert's assessment. And we'll learn why a Wake County judge decided not to leap into the controversy surrounding North Carolina's 9th congressional district race. Speaking of that 9th district, Donna Martinez joins us now with more on that subject. Here's the Carolina Journal headline.
This week, all eyes will be on a State Board of Elections hearing in Raleigh as the board takes up the investigation into the still unresolved question of who actually won November's race for the 9th District congressional seat in the United States House of Representatives. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Carolina Journal has been following this story very closely. He joins us now with a preview of the hearings to come. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
Recap for us, if you would, election night in November of 2018. We did have what we thought was a winner in this this race for a House seat.
Right. We had, from early returns, about a 900-vote margin of victory for Mark Harris, the Republican nominee. This seat was open because Harris defeated the incumbent, Representative Robert Pittenger, in the Republican primary. So this was an open seat, no incumbent going back to Washington. Harris won by about 900 votes over his Democratic opponent, Dan McCready. There was also a Libertarian in the race as well, but the two main candidates were McCready and Harris. And after that was over, the race was over, McCready conceded, Harris accepted victory, and we thought we were going to move on. But reports started coming out of potential irregularities from that district, including allegations of mishandled or destroyed or stolen absentee ballots coming particularly from Bladen County, to some extent from Robeson County, and numbers of absentee participation that were way off the charts disproportionately in Bladen and Robeson County compared to other counties, not only in the district but statewide. And so people got interested, and that's when the State Board of Elections got involved.
Now, Dan McCready, the Democrat, actually rescinded his concession.
Yes.
Mark Harris, the Republican, he and the state's Republican Party have repeatedly called for him to be certified
Correct.
As the winner, but none of that has happened. So for now, the folks who live in the 9th Congressional District of North Carolina technically do not have representation
That's right.
In the U.S. House. Let's look at what this new board is going to look into. We'll talk about the board itself in just a moment, but are they going to be taking testimony, or is this open to the public, or is this closed?
This is an open session. They are limiting seating. The actual hearing is going to take place in the State Bar Building downtown Raleigh because they have a very large hearing room where they quite often hold judicial hearings and things like that. And so, but there is going to be limited seating. There's going to be a lot of interest in it, but there will
be. But Carolina Journal will be there.
That's right. And there's going to be a closed circuit feed also available, and this will be live streamed as well. So this people will be able to see this. Should be able to see this statewide. They will take evidence. There right now is a portal at the State Board of Elections site where documents will be filed and posted. And right now already there are all the documents of evidence available for people to review right now at the State Board of Elections website, and they can look at this and see what's available. As other evidence is submitted for the board to consider, that'll also be posted online. And so people can look at this. And yes, witnesses will be called. They'll be sworn. They'll be taking testimony under they'll be giving testimony under oath. There will be law enforcement people who will testify. And it's going to be a very, very thorough hearing to weigh the evidence. And basically the question the board has before it is, should Mark Harris be certified, or is there enough evidence presented to cast doubt on the reliability of the returns. Not necessarily are there enough ballots in question that were somehow or another invalidated and would make a difference of 905 votes, but was there enough evidence to suggest that there may be some taint in the election that would justify call for a new election? And that's what the board will decide. Now, this is a five-member board. Four of the five members have to agree to that. Three are Democrats.
Four, not just three. Four have to agree.
That's right, to call for an election. That's right, to call for an election. To certify, it only takes three. But there are three Democrats and two Republicans, and so it will require bipartisan support to call for a new election in the ninth.
Rick, do we know if the two major candidates are planning to be there to testify? That would be Mr. Harris, Reverend Harris, and Mr. McCready?
We don't know if Reverend Harris is going to be there because he's been suffering from a viral infection and he is home now, but he was hospitalized for a while and he may not be well enough to attend the hearing. Dan McCready will be there, whether or not he himself may be called to testify. We don't have a witness list yet, so we don't know. Reverend Harris may also be called to testify. It's always possible that he could be deposed at a separate location or that he could be questioned remotely under oath if he's not able to travel from Charlotte to Raleigh.
Let me make sure I understand. So the two options that would come out of this hearing, which is thought to last at least two or three days, that's the anticipation,
right,
would be either Mark Harris is certified as the winner,
right,
or they call for a new election?
Those are the two that are the most likely. Now, if he is not certified and they don't call for a new election, then we're basically where we started from before the hearing, other than the fact that we do have evidence presented under oath. We do have testimony under oath, which we don't have right now. We have sworn affidavits, but some of those affidavits have been called into question as to their veracity. So
what you're describing, Rick, almost sounds like a traditional trial that one would see on court TV or something,
right,
like
that.
Right,
but the burden of proof is set at a different standard than a criminal trial, for instance, or something like that.
Is that preponderance of
yes,
the evidence,
right,
as the board determines?
That's correct. That's right. So what the board will be making some judgment calls here too. But if you can't get four members to call for a new election, and even if the candidate's certified, he still has to go to the U.S. House of Representatives to present himself to be seated. And
that's the big question mark too.
Well,
because if this board certifies him, is the U.S. House, which is now under Democratic Party leadership, would they be required to acknowledge him as the winner, the Republican, and seat him?
No, they would not be. And they're never required to actually accept any candidate who presents himself before them. They always have the option of denying that. What this hearing may do is provide enough evidence for them to say, well, it looks like Harris won, or it looks like there's enough in doubt for us to call for a new election. The House would really prefer for the state to do this. They would prefer not to get involved in state-level election politics, but sometimes it's essential. If you can't get four votes to call for a new election, or if you certify someone and the members of the House are not convinced that there's enough justification to see him, or if the board says, no, we won't certify him, if there's a total deadlock, then the House will get involved at that point.
Once a determination, whatever it is made by this state board of elections, could either candidate, whoever comes out on the so-called losing end, then say, hey, wait a second, I'm going to sue?
There's a possibility for redress in the courts, but basically that's irrelevant because at the point that the board makes a decision, then the U.S. House essentially takes jurisdiction at that point. I mean, you could go to court and sue and say they didn't consider this piece of evidence or that piece of evidence, but it really doesn't matter because eventually the U.S. House is going to decide this. If the U.S. House were not concerned about getting involved in state elections, which would give people incentives to challenge all sorts of things and hope that the House decides in their favor, if that weren't the case, the U.S. House probably would have taken jurisdiction over this long ago, but they didn't.
So to recap, you're saying that it would take four out of the five board members to agree on a new election,
right,
to call for a new election, but
right,
it would only take three of the five board members to certify Reverend Harris as the winner.
Right.
On election night, he was ahead by
yes,
900 votes or so. Do we know, have either of the candidates been preparing for a new election?
Dan McCready is raising money as if there's going to be a new election. I don't know if Mark Harris is doing so. Mark Harris went to Washington and did orientation and acted very much like a representative-elect.
This State Board of Elections hearing is scheduled to begin on Monday. Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Should college athletes get paychecks? It's a hot national topic, but former North Carolina Supreme Court Justice Bob Orr says the debate over paying athletes serves as a distraction from more pressing concerns. He recently explained to state lawmakers.
I am absolutely confident that the NCAA and certain member institutions within the system who don't want to see change and who don't want to share the gold that the Golden Goose has delivered, all want us to be talking about paying players. They want us to talk about paying players because basically that's kind of an unpopular position that those of us in the reform movement have advocated for. They want us to become mired in the quagmire of compensation models that pit men's sports against women's sports, major revenue sports versus Olympic sports, bench warmers versus All-Americans, small schools versus big schools, all of the permutations of compensation models that will lead the discussion in circles, provoke controversy and litigation, and ultimately forestall any significant change.
Or wants a state legislative commission to focus on another idea.
As a result of these circumstances, I would submit to the commission one fairly simple and straightforward reform that needs to be made and would accomplish substantial progress in this area and greater justice to the students. That simple proposal is to stop punishing college athletes from benefiting financially from their skills and success in a particular sport. This basic concept can be founded on what I think is one of the truly important provisions in our own state constitution. Article 1, Section 1 of the Declaration of Rights sets out certain inalienable rights, including the right to the enjoyment of the fruits of their own labor. This right, which was adopted in 1868 by the people of this state, was obviously grounded in the history of an enslaved people obligated to work for the benefit of others but unable to benefit for themselves and enjoy the fruits of their own labor. This constitutional provision has been used over the years in a broader context to protect individual citizens from government overreach in the regulatory sphere. But the principle is directly applicable to the young men and women working for their respective schools in the big-time business of college athletics.
Or points to the rights of the students themselves.
Shouldn't these athletes be able to enjoy the fruits or benefits of their own labor without being punished for receiving those benefits? One can only imagine. The free market value of Clemson freshman quarterback Trevor Lawrence, who just this week led Clemson to the national championship in football. How much would his presence be worth on another college campus, and how much would the free market system pay him to make that move? But not only is that type of compensation forbidden and punishable by being forever banned from college sports, but the more mundane types of benefits, from a hometown fan treating him to dinner, to opportunities to make a little extra money doing ads for Uncle Mo's used car sales, is forbidden and punishable. The infamous NCAA impermissible benefits rule would immediately kick in, and Lawrence or any other college athlete given such a monetary opportunity would find himself or herself ineligible to participate in college sports, lose their scholarship, and perhaps have to leave college if they came from a low-wealth family.
Former North Carolina Supreme Court Justice Bob Orr explains how athletes differ from others on college campuses.
In fact, on every campus in the UNC system and across the country, everyone from chancellors to the athletic directors to the coaches to research professors, all the way to talented student musicians, actors, writers, programmers, whatever, can benefit financially from the value of their specific talents, except college athletes. College athletes can only receive those benefits specifically approved by the NCAA.
Orr says the NCAA rules are based on out-of-date thinking about college sports.
All of these NCAA prohibitions and limitations are founded on the antiquated and totally hypocritical concept of the collegiate model. The NCAA manual proclaims, quote, the commitment to amateurism. Member institutions shall conduct their athletic programs for students who choose to participate in intercollegiate athletics as part of their educational experience and in accordance with NCAA bylaws, thus maintaining a line of demarcation between student athletes who participate in the collegiate model and athletes competing in the professional model. This reliance on the old British aristocracy concept of amateurism to keep students competing in college athletics completely under the control of their NCAA masters is not only outmoded, but totally hypocritical.
Or contrasted amateur athletics with the type of big-time college sports we see today.
Does anybody think they saw a nice amateur football game between Clemson and Alabama? Or amateur basketball game between the Tar Heels and the Wolfpack? And to top off this monumental hypocrisy, Rule 2.9 in the NCAA manual, titled The Principles of Amateurism, the principle states student athletes shall be amateurs in intercollegiate sport, and their participation should be motivated primarily by education and by the physical, mental, and social benefits to be derived. Student participation in intercollegiate athletics is an avocation, and I got to tell you, this is the part I love, student athletes should be protected from exploitation by professional and commercial enterprises. The hypocrisy of that concept is beyond belief.
Or explain the hypocrisy.
You go or watch any major collegiate event, and you will be inundated by the commercial exploitation of the young men and women uniformed up with all sorts of branding on their shoes, uniforms, water bottles, all around the arena and in the media. Everybody is making money off their talents, not the least of which is the NCAA's commercial windfall of around $1 billion a year simply for running a basketball tournament.
Bob Orr says the students are the only ones not making money from big-time college sports.
Everybody financially benefits within this athletic marketplace, except the students, who are the workforce, the talent, the stars, who put in 40-hour-plus work weeks, month in and month out. But they're totally limited in their ability to benefit personally from the fruits of their own labor by an oppressive and unfair financial compensation system that punishes the student for any benefit the NCAA does not permit. I would submit to you that in order to seriously come up with a system that is fair and workable, the proverbial sword of Damocles cannot continue to be held over the heads of these young men and women who want to play a college sport. When the punishment of ineligibility for receiving financial benefit is removed from the equation and college athletes and their representatives can be treated like everyone else in the system, then solutions for compensation can be reached.
That's former North Carolina Supreme Court Justice Bob Orr making a recent presentation to the state's Legislative Commission on the Fair Treatment of Student Athletes. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the course of the fight over North Carolina's 9th District Congressional election, Republican candidate Mark Harris asked a judge to declare him the winner. But Judge Paul Ridgway was skeptical. He asked whether Harris had any other remedy than going to court.
One remedy is simply waiting 10 days and petitioning the newly constituted Board of Elections in the ordinary course of things, petitioning, making exactly these same arguments to the board that has the investigation in front of it, that has the complete record in front of it, that has the authority to issue a certification, that has the authority to make its position clear, and to simply allow that board to make a final agency decision that then your client's right to appeal, the state's rights to appeal, whoever wishes to appeal would have that opportunity and it would come into the ordinary course of things. Why are we looking at a dramatic intervention by one branch of government into the functioning of another branch of government? And I'll add that in the new legislation, it does say that investigations shall continue uninterrupted in the hands of the new board.
Republican Mark Harris's attorneys responded to Ridgway's concerns.
And the reason I think it's necessary for the court to get involved is for certainty. The court can enter mandamus and we'll know what we're going to be dealing with. with everything that we're going to have under the new board, whenever that hearing is going to be set up, what the parameters are going to be of that hearing. We just don't know, although they might be in existence as of the 31st, we don't know when that's going to get in place. And at this point, we're a couple months past the election, and you don't have the residents of the 9th District being represented in Congress. So we think this provides a certainty for this term of the election, for this next 2 years, which I submit to you will not be as certain when we're going back under the old board, under this new statute.
That argument didn't sway Judge Ridgway.
It's perhaps no less uncertain than whatever a court may choose to do in the appellate process of whether, I mean, this is an extremely unusual situation with no board in place, and asking this court to step in and exert extraordinary power to declare the victor in an election that is clearly a purview of other branches of government. I mean, it would be highly unusual for this court to step in and say, we require certification of, in a contested race with an investigation pending, we require certification. That's an extraordinary step to ask a court to do.
That's Wake County Judge Paul Ridgway. He's explaining why he decided not to step into the fight over North Carolina's contested 9th District congressional election. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock. Just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The loss of community has had a major negative impact on American society and on societies throughout the West. That's an argument Jonah Goldberg has been making. The National Review senior editor and American Enterprise Institute scholar recently visited Chapel Hill. Among Goldberg's concerns, the impact of social media on real relationships.
We retreat from real communities and we go in fake ones like Facebook. I think Facebook is essentially a envy machine where we curate our lives, make it seem like we're having a better time than we really are. But the worst part of that is politically, is when we go on Facebook or when we retreat to Fox News or to MSNBC or whatever website that tells us what we want to hear rather than what we need to hear, we have all of our biases confirmed, all of our worst instincts confirmed and ratified. To the extent where we no longer can hear anybody who disagrees with us and not think they're insulting us or that they're the enemy.
This loss of community is just one of the problems Goldberg describes in his most recent book. It's called Suicide of the West. Why?
For a very long time, the working title, which I still like a lot, is The Tribe of Liberty. Because part of my argument was that mere reason isn't enough. Mere, you know, economic efficiency isn't enough. As Chesterton likes to say, the purely rational soldier will not fight, the purely rational man will not marry. You need higher principles, ideas, value structures, permission structures to civilize people. And one of the things that we need is a tribal attachment to liberty. We don't get liberty from the Constitution. The Constitution is in many ways the end process of a bizarre cultural evolution that takes place on the ground in England, where a lot of the customs and habits of liberty emerge as organic artifacts of a lived experience. And what the Founding Fathers did, the glorious thing about what the Founding Fathers did is they took these cultural norms, because they considered themselves for the longest time British citizens. That's why they were mad. And they felt that their what they called their ancient rights and liberties were being violated. And so what they did is they sort of put these customs and norms in a centrifuge and purified them and made them into abstract principles and then wrote them down. And that was a great gift. But for whatever reason, the publisher had a problem with Tribe of Liberty. Salespeople couldn't understand it. They thought this was, and so we had this long negotiation. And one of the reasons why I didn't go with Death of the West or the End of the West or the Decline of the West is that I don't believe in the phrase, I think the phrase, the right side of history is garbage. It has a certain, as Richard Pipes likes to say, has a certain Marxist twang to it. Nothing is inevitable. You know, that's the point of when Reagan said, we're never more than one generation from tyranny. It requires effort. Civilization requires effort. And I'm not trying to belittle anybody with mental health issues, but suicide is a choice. We are making a choice to go down a certain path. And we can make a choice to get out of it.
You worry about the collapse of a Western economic miracle. Why are you so concerned?
One of my intellectual, you know, main influences for this book was an economic historian, Deirdre McCloskey, who argues that the miracle emerges basically because of words. The story that we tell ourselves about ourselves radically changed for the first time in the late 1600s. In profound ways. I call it the Lockean Revolution, this idea that our rights come from God, not from government. We are citizens, not subjects. The fruits of our labors belong to us. Innovation is a good thing, which for most of human history was seen as very suspect because it challenged the powers that be in the status quo. And that emerged through words and ideas and rhetoric. And I don't think Deirdre has fully explained where the miracle comes from, but I think she's explained an indispensable part of it. And it is true, though, that if you take it as true that you can talk yourselves into the miracle, you can talk yourselves out of it. And that is what I think is happening in higher education, in popular culture, and in our politics, is that we are making arguments that are throwing the Constitution, the principles that it represents, the cultural inheritance that we have, we're throwing it all away in this spat of our tribalism and nationalism and identity politics, all of which run counter to this glorious idea that the individual is sovereign, that we are captains of ourselves, and that the market is not just good, it is the only anti-poverty program that has ever worked in all of human history, and we're taking it all for granted. And that's ingratitude, and that is a suicidal choice.
If it's a choice to reject the values, the principles that help propel Western prosperity, that seems to leave the door open for us to make a different choice, to embrace those values and principles again.
That's right. That's right. Charles Krauthammer, my late friend, he gave a wonderful speech a few years ago called titled Decline is a Choice. We, you know, whether it's the entitlement crisis or a host of other things, we know, or at least enough people of good faith know what we have to do. It's just too damn hard. I mean, I don't mean to sound like Al Pacino in Scent of the Woman about knowing the right path and not taking it because it's too damn hard. But the thing is, if we don't choose to go to correct, things will just get worse. And we're going to have to answer to our kids or our grandkids why we let things go down the sewer the way we have. And again, I'm ultimately an optimist. You know, Edmund Burke says, example is the school of mankind and he will learn it no other. And what it means by that is sometimes you have to show people. You can't just tell people. Ed Koch, who was mayor of New York City for two terms, and when he lost his third bid, he was asked if he was ever going to run again. And he said, no. The people of New York fired me, and now they must be punished. And we're going to learn some lessons from the Obama years and from the Trump years, and we have a choice to act on those lessons or to compound the problems that led us that way. One of the great things about liberal democratic capitalism is its capacity for self-correction. And I still think we have that. I also think that the arguments that we're seeing on these carnival stall shout shows of cable news and on talk radio and on the internet actually doesn't reflect the majority of the American people. When you go out in the real world, in the real country, and you talk to real people, people have sometimes profound differences with other people. But this is a deeply, deeply decent country with a wellspring of good intentions and moral seriousness. And what we lack is the ability to marshal political passion around those attributes. But I think just as this country produced a Lincoln when it needed it, we may be able to produce the kind of leadership that is required, because we really have no other choice.
That's Jonah Goldberg, scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, senior editor at National Review, author, most recently, of the book titled Suicide of the West, How the Rebirth of Tribalism, Populism, Nationalism, and Identity Politics is Destroying American Democracy. He spoke recently in Chapel Hill. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. New data from state education officials shows that the percentage of teachers leaving North Carolina classrooms has actually declined for 3 years in a row. Now, technically, this is called the teacher attrition rate, and it's a key piece of data in the ongoing discussion about where we go as a state when it comes to teachers, to students, and parents. Dr. Terry Stoops is vice president for research, also the director of education studies for the John Locke Foundation. He's been looking into the numbers, and he joins me now. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
First of all, give us a sense of what the data actually shows.
Well, the data for this year shows that around 8% of the teacher workforce, so roughly 95,000 teachers in district schools, left the profession. This doesn't include, as it has in years past, the number of teachers that go from one district school to another district school. These are just teachers that left the profession. And the report details the reasons why the teachers report they have left the profession. So as in years past, there's a number of options that teachers can choose from when they leave, and they can tell researchers the reason why they left. And then researchers have gone one step further in the reports the last few years to look at the quality of those teachers, how they perform, how their students performed on state tests, where they were in their profession, et cetera.
Before we get into a discussion of what teachers are saying about the fact that they're leaving 3 years in a row, then we've seen a decline here?
That's right. So 3 years ago, we were at around 9%. The attrition rate was around 9%. Now we're getting closer to 8% with some change. So this is the third year in a row that we've seen a decline. This is also in the midst of a string of teacher pay increases. So that might be a factor in why we're seeing a decline. But, this is positive news. You would think it would be positive news for those who appreciate the fact that teachers are staying in the classroom.
Why are they saying they're leaving?
Well, as in years past, they're saying that they're leaving mostly for personal reasons or retirement. The story has largely been the same, even even in years that we didn't quite calculate the rate in the same way, is that teachers are saying, listen, I've had a spouse move out of state. I've had various personal circumstances to deal with that don't allow me to stay in the classroom, or I've just decided to retire. These are predominantly the reasons why teachers are reporting, self-reporting, why they're leaving the profession.
A lot of the same reasons that people leave jobs in a multitude of industries, just situations change.
That's right. So, you know, it sort of begs the question, too, of what can the state do if there are personal circumstances behind someone leaving? Obviously, the state can't step in and say, no, your husband can't take that job out of state. Right. Therefore, you have to stay in your teaching job.
The reason that we're talking about this is, at least in part, the fact that there has been a narrative over the past several years among at least some advocates for public education in North Carolina. And the narrative has been that the current leadership of the General Assembly doesn't respect teachers, doesn't care about compensating teachers, and that lots and lots of teachers are therefore leaving North Carolina. But the data really refutes that narrative.
It really does. So we don't have a teacher turnover problem in North Carolina, but we have the perception of a teacher turnover problem. And the perception is that things have gotten so bad under the Republican leadership that teachers can't wait to leave the profession for any number of other employment opportunities. That's just not the case. There is no teacher turnover problem in North Carolina, and these numbers play that out. If you look at the reasons why teachers leave and you look at some of the ones that may indicate that they're not satisfied, such as choosing a different profession or leaving because they don't like teaching, that would account for about 1% of the teacher workforce. In other words, of the 95,000 teachers that teach in our schools, only about 1,000 of those leave the profession because they're unhappy with it. That's an extremely small number of folks that are discontented with the profession. And that discontentment may have nothing to do with the policies passed by the General Assembly. It may have everything to do with a principal that doesn't like them, with kids that don't respect them, or a district that doesn't think that they're doing a very good job. So the idea that teachers are leaving the profession in droves because of policies passed by the General Assembly is not backed by the data. And yet, that's all we hear when we turn on the TV or open the newspaper, is that things have gotten so bad for teachers that they can't wait to leave.
In fact, over the past several years, we have seen raises in multiple years given to teachers. And yet, part of that narrative is that there is not a respect that is reflected in teacher pay.
That's right. And honestly, if I were on the left, I would say, look, the reason why the teacher attrition rate is getting so much better is because we're paying teachers more. But they don't want to say that for obvious reasons, because they don't want to let everyone know that things are actually a lot better as far as compensation. And we're not just talking about salary increases. We're talking about increases in benefit payments to teachers. So on top of the average teacher salary, we're looking at another $17,000 to $18,000 in benefits, the cost of which keeps going up and the cost of which the General Assembly keeps pouring money into.
Terry, you mentioned something a few moments ago that I think is pretty fascinating. Evidently, researchers have gone beyond just asking teachers, why are you leaving? They actually are trying to look into the performance of teachers who are leaving versus those who are staying. Tell us more about that.
Yes. Well, and this is a real advancement in the teacher turnover report compared to previous years, is that they've started looking at the growth data. In other words, are the students that have these teachers growing by at least 1 year's worth of growth, according to the various metrics that we have in the state to be able to measure student growth? And what we find is that teachers that leave don't have the type of growth, don't have the type of growth scores that teachers do that stay in the profession. In other words, the teachers that leave are less quality teachers than those who stay. Now, this is good news, right? Or at least it should be, because we want the bad teachers to leave. We want the less capable teachers to leave the profession. We want better ones to stay. This is the benefit of attrition, is that we can make improvements in the teacher workforce when the good teachers stay and the bad teachers leave. And this report indicates that's exactly what's happening.
Terry, if there are teachers who are less qualified for whatever reason, is there Any thought of taking a look at how they are being trained to be classroom teachers? I mean, what's going on in education schools that at least in some cases appears to not be adequately preparing people for the reality of being in charge of a group of kids?
Well, we started having that conversation, and then things in the UNC system sort of went awry. And so the discussion we started having about teacher education and specifically how teachers are trained to teach reading is something that was started just a year or two ago. But unfortunately, with turnover, with Margaret Spellings leaving in particular –
head of the UNC system.
Head of the UNC system. Unfortunately, that's going to put a stop to the really legitimate line of inquiry about whether schools of education are training teachers properly. Now, the other side of this is that a great deal of our teacher workforce, up to maybe as much as half of our teacher workforce, are trained in other states. So we have to consider whether the teacher training that is occurring in other states is up to par to what we could provide in North Carolina, because we import such a large percentage of our teachers from states that have a surplus of teacher candidates.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the show this week. Appreciate you listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Please join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.